memes. It's people! It's people! Hello and welcome to episode 156 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other post-apocalyptic survivors with bad fashion sense as masterpieces. I am Nick, the eco-warrior of the podcast, and I am joined as ever by Roger.
Well, I guess I just ought to shoot somebody. Actually, that doesn't put it down very much.
And we are discussing not one, not two, but a trio of 70 science fiction films. No, not the big Star Wars one. The ones that came out before that. What you would think of as early 70s science fiction, though. They're not all early 70s.
Yeah, this is something that we've been talking about on and off for a while. Everybody who was there says, particularly everybody who's working in film at the time, says Star Wars was completely revolutionary in terms of what it made science fiction films into. So we thought we'd look at some of the ones that were just before that.
Yes. I wasn't actually particularly wondering about the difference Star Wars made when we started, but I have to say at the end, it made me realise it was helpful to see what a revolution Star Wars was. But we'll talk it through. So we've got a trio of delights for you, which we'll do in chronological order, which always surprises me that they're in this order. We have 1972's Silent Running. We have 1973's Soylent Green and 1976's Logan's Run, just 1 year before the behemoth of Star Wars came out. So let's take them in order, I guess.
So we should probably say huge spoilers for all of these. It's kind of hard to spoil them. They've all become somewhat part of pop culture anyway, so.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't know the ending to Soylent Green, to be honest, that's the only thing I knew about Soylent Green when I started watching it. So, but if you don't want to know the ending at all, then go and watch them first. But Silent Running.
Yeah.
So Douglas Trumbull's is one of his first pictures, maybe his only picture. I'm not sure. I haven't investigated.
He's known as a special effects guy. He was, for example, the special effects guy on 2001.
Mm.
He worked on a lot of other things. I think he did Close Encounters. So on, particularly that he's something of a classic on the whole detailed spaceship. So you can zoom in close and move over it and get the impression this is huge and real.
This might be why, to my eye, I'm always slightly surprised Silent Running comes first, because it looks, special effects wise at least, a bit less dated than both Logan's Run and Soylent Green.
The guy was really good as a special effects guy.
Yeah.
In fact,
the models are beautiful.
This had its genesis in 2001 because the original plan was to have a Saturn flyby for Discovery.
I see. Okay, which is why they randomly end up near Saturn.
And then basically, it got shifted to Jupiter and cut back a bit, and yeah.
Oh, yes, Jupiter.
2001 is as it happened. But that was a thing that he had wanted to do, and there's a bit in here which is very much, here is what I wanted to do on 2001, but that bastard director wouldn't let me.
So I'm going to crowbar it into this film.
Mm-hmm.
So the basic idea, such that it is humanity seems happy and healthy and well on Earth, but they've concreted over all the forest, which for some reason the best, I don't want to think about the science too much, but it seems to be that the easiest way to save them was to launch all of them into space and put them in orbit around Jupiter or Saturn.
Yeah, and all right, yeah, we are both science fiction gamers, and yes, we poke at these things. So, all right, let us say for the sake of argument that you have an Earth environment that the forests can't live in, for whatever reason. Given that humans can live in it, maybe you've way increased the oxygen percentage. So, apart from things catching fire a lot, that could be quite good.
Yeah, nobody smoked.
Anyway, so you need to put them in an isolated environment. So you've got these airtight domes. Clearly you can build these airtight domes because they have to build them for the spaceships. Why do you not put that airtight dome in, say, Antarctica, where you have free gravity and cooling and heating.
Are you suggesting that the cost of launching an entire forest into space? I mean, well, it's
not even the cost. It's just I don't see what it gets you.
Well, also, like,
other than
again,
this film,
we probably yes, exactly. We probably shouldn't pick into it too deeply. But automatically, the premise doesn't make any sense to me. Either these things were launched as forests, or they were grown in space, in which case they don't seem to have any problems with zero gravity. Although they seem to have artificial gravity on these ships.
I think we have to grant that as a narrative convention because
okay, I mean, they don't mention it, but that's fine.
I suspect few people knew better than Trumbull, in fact, how hard and expensive it is to do convincing zero G after 2001, where it was done pretty darn well.
So when was 2001? It was 1968, according to my internet. So 4 years before this film.
Mm-hmm.
And it again, that looks less dated than any of the other films.
Yeah, the guy was good. The costume designers were good. The set designers were good. You know.
You might call the style today, if you were using the convention of calling everything something punk, which doesn't really make sense, but NASA punk, I've heard this kind described as. It is kind of a NASA semi-realistic, or at least realistic as regards the American space program, kind of aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. It turns out, that's the old thing, because it's described as in orbit around Jupiter, or more to the point, Saturn. But, well, why?
Yeah.
And is it actually intended to be? That's the other thing, during later events, they need to do a close pass on Saturn, yes. Is it meant to be realistic in that that's where they were in the first place? Or is it a matter of he doesn't really know how big space distances are and thinks that they might have been in Earth orbit or somewhere and then we casually go to Saturn because we can? I'm not sure there's anything in the film to support either reading as a distinctive thing.
Well, my assumption was they were in Earth orbit because that just made sense to me, but I don't know if they mention it, but at some point you realise that they're actually around Saturn. And by they, it's not just one of these arc ships, there's several of them, all of which have several domes, presumably with different, I think they are labelled as different regional forests and ecosystems.
I mean, let's talk word building here. These are American Airlines space freighters.
Yes, that
implies that there is enough space traffic that it's worth building a space freighter and putting it into commercial service.
Yeah.
There are places these guys are going. We never hear about them. We just hear about Earth.
It may be they've got a space elevator, I suppose. We have to assume a lot of technology. Anyway, we have to accept the premise. All of Earth's forests, all that's left of them, are now in space around Jupiter and looked after by a handful of guys.
Yeah,
else other than a white guy, I think.
On this ship, which is the only one we go inside, we have four crew, and that's it.
Yeah, on this giant...
And they're looking after six forest domes.
And they are... So we have Bruce Dern, who we've not had in Ribbon of Muse before, as this kind of gardener caretaker who actually cares about the forest, and the other jerks, who we're clearly meant to think of as jerks, who don't. Except they are given some slight characterisation, and he obviously does get on with them a bit... But then they're given the order to blow up all the forests because it's too expensive now to maintain them. Maybe they should have thought about that before they blasted them into orbit.
Well, why blow them up? Why not just jettison them and abandon them? It doesn't save you anything. And nukes are quite expensive. Nukes are clearly not expensive in this world. They're casually in a cupboard, but...
Well, I guess the answer to why is plot. The whole point is... Oh my God, look at this. Earth is casually discarding all of its forests. What a way. And it comes out of the whole Silent Spring metaphor for, what are we doing to the environment? Which I am no opponent of. You know, we are doing disastrous things to our own environment at the moment. I suppose I take a more anthropocentric view of the environment in the sense that we live on one planet and if we make it unlivable, we're knackered. The Earth will be fine without us, but we will be dead.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, we get the argument in the mess where the other guys are clearly trying to make the case for, hey, you know, Earth is not so bad these days.
Yeah.
Everybody's got a job, everybody's got somewhere to live and so on. These seem to be things that you don't casually throw away, even if the price is forests. At the very least, an argument to be made, and nobody's really arguing, they're just saying, this!
Yes, we never find out if Earth is the utopia they describe, but the society they describe is one that hasn't been seen in human existence and sounds pretty good. So, yeah, maybe the price to pay is biodiversity. But Bruce, or whatever his character is called, the gardener, will have none of this. And so in fairly short order, pretty early in the film, dispatches his three colleagues, two of them by attaching, when they're in the forest preparing things, he just launches it off and blows it up. And the other one by murdering him.
Bruce, you just lost half the remaining biodiversity you're trying to save.
He only saves one forest in the end. Part of the problem I have with this film, he's just quite an unlikable character. He's an intolerant, murderous dickhead, as far as I can tell. So I didn't have a lot of sympathy for him. I understand he's an eco-warrior, but as you say, he also casually discards at least a third of the thing he was trying to save. He only makes his mind up when there's only one forest left. Don't know. I didn't have a lot of sympathy with him because of the way he behaves.
Also, we've said before, I think, that when I start getting preached at, I get annoyed. When I feel like getting preached at, I get annoyed. Ooh, look at these cute little animals that are about to die in a nuclear fireball.
Yes, I mean, it's a horrific idea. Yeah. So if you take the premise as it is, yes, it's an awful idea that we're just casting away these millions of years of evolution. But he's such an unsympathetic character that I don't find him...
Particularly the way he's costumed to start with, you know, he's in the robe, the other guys are in the jumpsuits. I can't help seeing him as a kind of 70s Jesus figure, you know, the aggro prophet vision of Jesus rather than the establishment vision of Jesus.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, there is a heavy-handed dose of 70s eco-warriorism to it, which is perhaps what dates him all, particularly the soundtrack, which is, it's not Joni Mitchell, is it? But it sounds
Joan Baez, and I've got to say, I have a lot of time for Joan Baez.
Yes.
And this is not one of her best moments. I mean, she's doing the kind of generic Whaley folk that became a cliche. And most of what she did is not that. Do not let this bias you against her. The other person on the soundtrack who did the electronic zings and things is Peter Schickele, better known as the inspiration of P.D.Q. Bach.
Oh, okay, yes. So they both have had...
So
better moments.
You've got these two really quite good musicians, and all he does is this. I mean, he could have made a film just by putting them in a studio and getting them to talk to each other.
I feel like that's not really their fault. That's got to be the fault of the editor. What it adds to is this sense of preachiness and a real heavy feeling that we should be horrified and on the side of Bruce Dern's character, Freeman Lowell. Lowell, he's called. And I'm just not. It just didn't work for me at all. And I found once he'd done the murdering, and then he modifies these little robot guys who were played by amputees, I think.
Yeah.
But there's something to them. They're relatively cute, but he's quite happy to sacrifice them as well. It's just a strange.
Well, no, he's not deliberately sacrificing them. One of them gets stuck as they're about to do the whole
Saturn
passage around Saturn thing.
Yeah, it gets blown off the thing. The other one,
it's sufficiently damaged after Freeman screws up.
Oh yes, that's right.
That he reckons he can't repair him. I still feel that if you know, what we get in the end is he is going to be caught for the crimes what he has done.
Yes.
And so he abandons the last dome, which apparently they won't chase down and blow up. Because
no, that'll
reasons.
Be fine.
Also, with the last drone in it. And it seems to me that if you had a malfunctioning drone, it could at least, you know, help repair the main drone.
Yeah,
a bit.
I don't know why, or at least it's a source of spare parts or something.
I realise this is the least bad option, but, you know, how long is this thing going to sustain itself without the power from the ship? all right, it's got sunlight. You know, a year, 2 years?
Well, it hasn't really got sunlight. I mean, he's the worst horticulturalist, so it takes him some time to work out that a plant needs sunlight. I mean, pretty basic biology. I don't know what power, maybe it's got fusion powder or something, but then he's using power from the ship to, as in these sun lamps, to light the plants. I don't know. That feels like a very inefficient way of doing it. Just move closer to the sun might be an easy way of doing it.
Solar system, anyway. Quite a big place. Yeah.
Yes. So to wrap Silent Running up, it wasn't for me. I have seen it before, and I remember it, I saw it when I was a very much more environmentally angered, conscious teen, and giving money to Greenpeace before I sort of looked into Greenpeace a bit more. It annoyed me then, to be honest, and I don't feel any better now. I don't know if it's Bruce Dern's unsympathetic performance or if it's the film's assumption that we should just automatically be on his side, even though I do think it shows him a bit warts and all. I don't think it's trying to show him as a messiah figure, but still I get the strong impression we are supposed to side with him.
Mm.
And I, while my ecological sympathies are with him, I don't like him. I don't sympathise with him. So,
sometimes the people you need are awkward buggers who won't compromise.
Very true.
There are some bits I wasn't impressed with. There are some bits I really liked. When they eject each dome, you get not just the dome being ejected, but that cloud and little metal flakes, which obviously everyone in the real world would have been familiar with from the Apollo mission footage. Yep. And that's beautifully done here. The interiors of the ship were shot aboard the USS Valley Forge, which was originally an Essex-class aircraft carrier, had been converted to an LPH. Basically, it saw action in Korea and Vietnam, but it was in the process of being retired and scrapped.
Right.
So they got use of that, and that works very well. And it's... I don't know quite how this is supposed to work as a ship. All right, we've got these cargo containers. They have their hold full of cargo containers.
Yeah. Which are an awkward shape.
There is a reason why cargo containers are always cuboid.
Yes, exactly. but okay. They have to look like space cargo containers, right?
Yeah. And presumably these are their rations, supplies, life support, all the rest of it. Mm. Is that what would be in the freighter when it's in freight service? Does it carry stuff on the spines as well? I'm much more interested in this world building that doesn't exist. Anyway.
Well, trying to dig into the world building is a bit of a lost cause in this one, I think.
Yeah. But I visually I like it. And that is undoubtedly Trumbull's strength.
Yes.
Sadly, it's not sort of...
I think what we're coming down to it, you know, the special effects and the visual design are great.
Mm.
It's almost Blade Runner-esque in that it's much more style than substance, but even Blade Runner, I didn't get into that. Blade Runner, the substance there is quite meaty. Anyway, didn't work for me. Not a masterpiece.
I'll agree there.
Not really doing anything new, particularly.
Well, I enjoyed it more last time I saw it, but that was many years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea. It just feels very of its time, a bit nonsense. Got too much like a fable, but dressed up as a realistic science fiction thing.
Mm.
It doesn't make a lot of sense.
In terms of the public reaction, it was a critical, huge success. Something of a box office failure, possibly not for the reasons we've been talking about, because Universal decided that they were going to see if a film could be advertised by word of mouth only, because that would be way cheaper if it could. And it turned out it couldn't.
They probably do that better nowadays, but
I think the idea was, you know, all these counterculture people are the same. We tell them Joan Baez is in it, they'll come along. That's all it needs.
It also it has the something of a common theme, as we'll discover. This kind of air of misery and humanity's going to hell in a handbasket, and we've cast away everything. There's no fun. There's no humour. It's just all depression all the time. And, you know, we've had our fair share. I like a bit of melancholy. We've had our fair share of, you know, The Pianist. We really do enjoy, well, we find that is worthwhile in some stories. It just feels a bit heaped on here, and I think we'll find that perhaps in our other two films as well, but we'll see. Shall we move on to Soylent Green?
Yeah, so the next year. And, all right, the first thing I saw, this is the one of these films that I had not previously seen.
Me either.
My first impression was from those introductory shots that are clearly establishing Eco Doom.
Yes.
Are we back in Adam Curtis land? It was that same style of quick shots that you don't really have time to look at.
Yes, but to give you a vague sense of thing, which in this case is the world's going to hell in a handbasket because, in this case, overpopulation.
But Charlton Heston is here to save you.
So this was peak Charlton Heston doing the terrifying last line. When was Planet of the Apes? A few years before this, I believe. But then we have that, damn you all to hell. It turns out it's Earth after all, even though a moment's reflection could have told you it must be Earth. Anyway, in this one, so Soylent Green is a film I suspect we both knew the twist. Well, we did both know.
Yeah, Futurama certainly riffed on this quite heavily.
Yes, exactly. But it is a highly overpopulated world.
This is not,
world.
I should point out, in the original book by Harry Harrison, Make Room, Make Room.
Is that a book or a short story?
Yes, it is a novel by Harry Harrison a year or two before this, and it is certainly very much about the overpopulation.
Mm.
But it doesn't have the big thing. It's basically saying, yes, here is overpopulation. It is terrible. It's getting worse. More or less.
I mean, the problem here is it's immediately undermined by the fact that, like, the population of New York currently is only, like, a million or so more than it was when they made the film because of reduced fertility rates. And now the worry, at least for people who think the Great Replacement Theory is of anything to think about, the worry now is that actually there's not enough of us and we're going to be outbred by those awful foreigners sort of thing.
I tend to feel the worry is also try not to stab oneself in the eye again with the fork. Anyway, Charlton Heston, before he was a joke.
Oh, God. Overpopulation is not really an issue. The issue is more that we're using more resources per head. But anyway, the premise of the story is that they're all being fed by these pharmaceutical companies that make kind of wafers out of plankton, and no one eats proper things anymore. We have returning.
It's theoretically available. It's just so stupidly expensive that nobody can afford it. Yeah.
So the rich live in these sort of giant arcology sort of buildings. We have Edward G. Robinson as someone who remembers. Lovely. He's what made the film for me. In so much as the film was made for me. We have these.
It's a bit of a stereotypical wise old Jew role. I mean, if you'd cast Topol in it, everybody would have said, yeah, sure.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's not.
But it does work because he is good.
It works because he knows what he's doing and he's very good. We have Charlton Heston as kind of a corrupt. I don't really like Charlton, and this is not because of his politics, which are not mine.
I just don't find him terribly sympathetic. Remember when you were talking about Steve McQueen as the kind of 70s manliness that you didn't get on with?
Yes.
That is the feeling I get from Charlton Heston here.
Okay, that's fair, and I think I would. I feel similarly about Charlton Heston. Yes, he's supposed to be this kind of charming guy. I just don't find him either particularly handsome or. Anyway, it doesn't work for me as a star.
Okay, let's casually rob the crime scene, shall we? Yeah.
Yes, I suppose an interesting take, but it's trying to have its cake and eat it in that he is a good detective, but he's doing what he has to do to survive. So he's kind of got morals, but hasn't got morals. There's a peculiar treatment of women in this film, which I think is trying to make a statement, but actually, because of the actions or the way Charlton Heston behaves, to me comes across as misogynistic in itself.
Yeah, there were two things that got to that. One was the idea that if you are high ranking enough to live in this exclusive apartment block, you, then you know a mistress comes with the apartment.
Yes, comes with the furniture, they're cool.
And clearly the idea that a woman might ever be powerful enough to write this is just, you know, nobody even thinks about that.
Mm.
Or a married man who doesn't want a mistress, you know, shocking.
Well, I don't mind that as a commentary on women in society. I think it's an interesting, but it feels a bit tangential and tacked on, and basically
it's there to get her there.
Yeah, so Charlton Heston can have a love interest, which he then treats pretty badly.
Yeah, and the feeling I got during a key scene was this is not a seduction. This is a rape, because she's not allowed to say no.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's...
And that was meant to be the great love story.
Yeah, I never really bought it as a love story. He is in a position of power over her, and as you say, she can't do a lot about it. Maybe she does genuinely have feelings for him, or maybe she's just terrified that he could presumably just kill her or arrest her or do anything he wants to her.
Yeah, rights. I think there would be a story to be told about somebody in that situation.
Yes, and that's not what we get.
This is a standard problem of relationships across power gradients, and the reason you don't do them is not because somebody can say yes, but because you can't be sure that they're saying yes out of, you know, anything other than survival pressure.
Yes. So I think that whole plot fails for me because, you know, it not only does it call her furniture and kind of try and say, look at how women are treated, but the film kind of treats her like furniture and doesn't give her any agency.
Mm. And she's just kind of discarded when she's not necessary to the plot anymore.
Yeah. More interesting, even then it's a little nonsensical. So Edward G. Robinson kind of discovers the truth.
So
one of the things
that, I can't even remember the character names now, one of the things Charlton Heston steals from the crime scene is a couple of leather-bound books which have hard information of the sort that is not generally available. And so...
Edward? Edward G. Robinson. So I should just point out, because I did not notice, but the rich guy at the beginning who is getting murdered is Joseph Cotten from Citizen Kane and from several other films we've watched.
All right. But so he steals this. So Sol takes a look at it and can't quite understand it, or at least doesn't want to follow through the implications of it. And takes it to, what do they call them, the council?
Yeah, this kind of council of elders who are sidelined by the big pharmaceutical companies.
And ultimately, as they discover, no, the oceans are dead as well. This is clearly not plankton. Wavy lines, therefore what they're doing is reprocessing corpses.
Yeah, but we don't get told that yet, because they have to save that for the big reveal. Mm-hmm. But everyone else kind of knows it. And instead of going to kind of talk to Detective Thorne, is Charlton Heston's
Thank
character.
You.
Instead of going to, like, talk to him or set a plan in motion, he immediately heads off to the youth sanatorium, or whatever it's called, to end his life.
Mm-hmm.
Which seems like an odd... Again,
all very
like,
Robert W. Chambers.
It feels like, oh, we've got to show this thing now. So this character is going to act as far as we... I mean, he was tired and depressed, but it feels out of character that he just abandoned his friend. Anyway, he does go off to kill himself. And that this is the scene that I don't know much enjoyed, but it's beautifully... I mean, Edward G. Robinson was dying of bladder cancer, I think, at the time. And this is his final... scene ever committed to celluloid, and it's his character dying, which is that's kind of beside the point, other than it is quite it doesn't move me to tears, but it is a moving scene of this old man seeing these things, and then Charlton Heston's character sort of running in at the end and seeing what Edward G. Robinson's character remembers and kind of saying, I never realized what it was like, I never understood, and that almost moved me. And then his character whispers something to Detective Thorne. Sol whispers something to Detective Thorne, which I think we must then understand, I think, is that he's saying Soylent Green is people, and Detective Thorne then has to go and get evidence for it.
Because this is 70s optimism. If the word gets out, the truth gets out, then things will have to change.
Well, as a detective, he has a funny idea of evidence compared to what
we get this quite effective action sequence, inevitably a sewage treatment plant. That's where you film stuff in California if you want works, because they don't have gas works like the UK. He sees, you know, here are corpses going in at one end of the machine, here are wafers coming out at the other end of the machine.
Corpses and bits of white cloth that the corpses are all wrapped in. I don't know if there's a machine to extract the body from them.
Please, essential dietary fiber.
Okay.
What he does is he sees. He doesn't take photographs.
No.
And all he's going to be doing, if he brings this evidence back, is talking to the council and saying, I saw this. I'm very ranty, but I'm not mad.
And the council saying, we told you that already.
Yeah.
I mean, easier evidence presumably would be a wafer of Soylent Green, which you would have thought some fairly basic chemical analysis would suggest, not plankton at least.
Mm.
Anyway, we've missed out a subplot with the chauffeur shooting him, and this riot scene with kind of bulldozers.
But, yeah, basically there is a conspiracy that's out to get him.
Yeah.
I was a little surprised in the riot scene because I thought it didn't quite go far enough. I mean, you've got these basically fairly conventional riot police with shotguns.
Yes.
And really these aren't riot helmets. The necks are so exposed. I mean, anyway. But, you know, and they have the scoops, which are what they use when the riot gets out of hand. Which, as you say, it's basically a garbage truck with a front loader.
Yeah.
So we go in, we scoop up the people, we tip them into the bag. It is strongly implied that nobody really cares what happens to them after that. They don't actually say, but I mean, many of them are going to be injured or dead from that anyway. So presumably they just go straight into the vats. If you're prepared to do that, why do you put the riot cops out there in the first place? Why not just machine gun them?
I agree. It could have been a really effective scene of look at what this has turned into. In fact, the whole, I totally agree. That could have been, if it was a much broader image and we saw these whole crowds being scooped up, or they were just machine gunned to death, or why even bother starting with, I agree. But in a way, that's a problem with it. Every so often, there's a scene with them treading over people and, look at how many people there are. But most of the rest of the film, they're in largely empty places. So it doesn't really get this sense of overcrowding all the time.
That's fair enough when you're doing the contrast of how the rich live and how the poor live. Mm. And every time Thorne goes in or out of his apartment, he has to step over the people sleeping on the stairs, that kind of thing.
But then he has a giant apartment without anyone in it. Is he rich? It doesn't. And also, you know, not getting into the fact, and maybe this is part of the problem, you know, Soylent Green, obviously feeding people other people from a pure energy point of view is not going to work for very long because you'll run it. Maybe that is being addressed by the film in that obviously...
I suppose you could use it to recycle amino acids and things and then put in a whole lot of synthetic sugars and fats.
Well, I guess the point is you still need a lot of energy. You know, you're losing energy at every level of that system. Mm. And feeding carnivores to carnivores is not...
Also a great way of getting diseases.
A really great way of getting beriberi or whatever. Maybe they deal with
Kuru,
it. Or maybe they don't care. And then because it's a 70s film, it has to end with honor just to kind of, it's people, which we didn't know. Everyone else in the film kind of knew at this point, but we have to know, it's people, Soylent Green is people. And then shock. And then we never know what happens. We never know if he just gets carted off and shot or it's just because...
In theory, he's been picked up by his police captain. So, who is, insofar as anybody has a friend in this, his friend, but thankfully that's not very far. Actually, just before that, I mean, the final action sequence, we've got the assassin stalking him through this church full of sleeping people, which, you know, both of them are trying not to wake people up to start with.
and that could be
a really effectively tense moment of sneaking through the thing. But this is a guy we've barely seen before, and B, a guy we don't particularly care whether he wins or not. We'd rather he didn't.
And I think that almost works quite well.
Show us Thorne stalking across that room; it would be much more effective.
Yeah, I agree that that's two set pieces we've talked about. That okay, but we've both felt could have been a lot more. Unfortunately for me, Soylent Green, I mean, again, as I was talking about in Silent Running, it's shot through with this kind of misery of, and it,
well,
it's
that,
even
that
more
was
so.
To some extent the tone of the time anyway, I think.
Yes. Well, that's why.
And we've talked before about how Hollywood tends to copy itself and copy itself until somebody does something amazing and different that makes money.
Well, I guess this is, that. This felt a bit more like coming off the American New Wave kind of stuff, in that it's just, no, you're not going to have a happy ending. No, you're not even going to get an ending, really. We're just going to end it here. Shock. And it has that kind of thing. But it, as with Silent Running, it doesn't, science fiction-wise, it doesn't make a ton of sense, and there's a lot of things happening because of plot. And it looks way more dated than Silent Running. So it doesn't work for me as a man. Maybe it was an original thing to have this. But even so, it feels like the ending of the, it's like the italicized line at the end of Lovecraft's stories, you know, when you've been hit with the thing that you're supposed to know. It's still less effective than Planet of the Apes, I feel.
And it feels like... I really ought to see someday, but yeah.
I like it a lot. I like it more than Soylent Green. But it's exactly the same premise of kind of Charlton Heston stumbles through a world that's horrible, and then there's a big shock at the end, and then the film ends. It's the same idea. I get spoilers for Planet of the Apes, but it is. if you don't know that. Not a masterpiece for me. I'm trying to make it... could it be really original? But it doesn't... No, maybe that specific thing of people eating people, but the whole tone of it doesn't feel very original to me. Or interesting. I didn't particularly enjoy watching it. Edward G. Robinson aside, I liked him. I didn't absolutely love it though. So
and a tiny part from Celia Lovsky as one of the council, whom I mentioned only because she was also T'Pau in Star Trek.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, there we go. But also is coming around.
But she does have that effect of move over, kiddies. A real actor has arrived.
yes.
The fact that it's a double act with Edward G. Robinson just makes this even better.
Whereas Heston's more of a star. I guess that's the problem with a star rather than an actor, is if you don't particularly gel with that star, you've not got much else to fall back on. Anyway, Logan's Run. So 3 years later, Logan's Run.
Yeah, so Star Wars, I think, is being made when this comes out.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so this is Michael Yore. This is the premise of Logan's Run. Again, if you don't know, so there's this utopian society of kids, but the catch is when you get to 30, you've got to, what do? They go into...
Carousel.
Carousel, which basically they kind of float up to a thing and explode, but some of them are supposed to actually reach the carousel and get renewed.
Some people think that they get renewed, reborn in some way, but yes. It's clear, I think, even at the start, that the people whose job is to hunt down the people who are trying to outstay their time, the Sandmen, don't really believe in this, or at least don't care.
Yeah, or you might think of it as, you know, someone who's deeply religious, that, you know, you sort of accept it, but you don't believe it yourself.
I should say, by the way, this is also a book adaptation. And in the book, it was anybody older than 21.
Yeah, well, I guess
they changed because they specifically to make the casting possible.
Yeah, okay.
But
I'm sure
that's
been
where
doable.
This is coming from. This whole panic about the young people today.
Right, I see. Yes, so that's the. What is the science fiction reason for them all dying at 30? Is it
I don't think they say
sustainable.
I think that's the suggestion, but I don't think they actually bother to say in the film. The implication is just, you know, this is the generation war, and you didn't write police down those kids when they were complaining about Vietnam, and this is where it's going to take you.
the fear behind it, I kind of get. I don't understand the rationale, really, but the whole place is run by an AI.
I mean, one could certainly make an argument, if one wanted to, that the older people get the more medical resources they require. I mean, 30 is a bit young for that, but, you know, it's there.
This is the population problem we're facing now. It will be a short-term problem as things correct itself, but Yeah, that we have many more older people.
That's the most cheerful prophecy of doom I've ever heard.
But it is. It's a problem that will solve itself eventually. Yeah, okay. So I guess it's trying to avoid the situation we're in now, in the older people who are drained on the resources.
Well, I don't think they've actually thought it through that far.
No, okay.
That would be a justification one could invent.
Aside from the Sandmen, no one else seems to have a job. They just fart around and have sex and...
Random sex.
They've got this dialer teleport technology, which is where Jenny Agutter comes in. I haven't seen I haven't seen Logan's Run either, though I was well familiar with it. I'm sure I would have remembered Jenny Agutter's costume because it's quite revealing when
there
she turns
up. Yeah.
Yes. Unlike the other two, I do like the main character. Michael York, I do feel, is quite charismatic.
Though he's also doing a very good job of ASAB. All sad men are bastards.
Okay, yes. Yeah, all right. That's about, yeah. Expound on that a little bit.
He is a pretty horrible person. His character, yes. I should say. I mean, I know nothing about Michael York. You know, he does one good thing in that when the woman who's turned up on the circuit says, "I've changed my mind, I don't want to have sex with you," he doesn't force her, which apparently he's quite able to do. But there's this whole thing let's talk about the plot a bit. The central controlling computer has got this idea that there is a place called Sanctuary,
where all these people are escaping to.
Yeah. And this is a bad thing and must be stopped. So
these are the people who refuse to go on the carousel and explode.
And run away instead.
Yep.
Quite how this harms the society that they've run away from is not clear, but never mind.
Good point.
But therefore he is set up to go undercover and be a runner. And therefore his palm crystal is turned to you're in your last week, I think it is.
Yeah, you had another couple of years to go yet or something, didn't you?
And so the thing that possibly this is just me being in a bad mood. He obviously talks the whole thing to the sanctuary contacts that he manages to make. I was a murdering bully boy, but it's different now. It's me, which
everyone accepts as a kind of don't quite accept it, but
there's this whole thing of presumably there is a point at which he genuinely decides not to pursue his undercover mission.
Yeah.
But I certainly couldn't spot a moment in the film where that was the case.
No, that is a problem. I thought it was going to be the slow journey from Bastard Sandman to Revelation. But actually, from the moment he gets the mission, he pretty much is a committed at that point. Now, that might be because genuinely he is like, shit, actually, I am going to go on the carousel. But yeah, there's no kind of Damascene conversion that we see anyway.
And he does ask when his clock is set forward. I'm going to get this time back later, right? And the AI just says nothing, which I rather like.
Sure you will.
It doesn't even say that. That's the point.
No, it doesn't. There's a silent implication that you won't. I mean, if that's not going to turn your top agent against you, I don't know what will. So it does. Anyway, he does then go on the run. The eponymous Logan goes on the eponymous run. And they escape from the city. And they get up to this weird kind of... they escape up through the kind of water purification plant.
It's described as a power plant, but it is in fact a different sewage works. It's not the same one but it looks pretty similar.
After sort of showing... There's a little scene where he shows his sympathies already, that he's not just going to shoot runners. Whether he's trying to do that to further win over the people at Sanctuary or whether he's already decided at this point isn't clear. But from this moment on, his sympathies seem to be with the runners, not the Sandmen. And they make it to this weird kind of robot creature that is freezing everyone who has hitherto made it up that far.
Well, originally it was supposed to be going out and freezing animals, fish in particular.
Yes.
To feed the city. Now it is not, because there aren't any fish, so it's freezing the people who come through instead. Apparently the city is not taking them up on this food supply, so this is not Soylent Green all over again.
It's not clear to me why there aren't any fish, because then, one, having defeated it, because Logan's the only one who's been there with a gun, apparently, I guess normal citizens don't get a gun, and he does.
Mm.
I ship, as the kids would say, I ship the love story. I quite like, there is some, going to be honest, blatant random nudity for no reason, particularly, let's get these wet clothes off kind of thing. And then a few minutes later, oh, let's put them back on again, even though they've presumably frozen solid by now.
Mm.
So the random exploitation and nudity is a little difficult. They make it to old Washington, D.C. I mean, the outside looks like overgrown. It's not like Silent Running, everything's dead, or Soylent Green, everything's dead. So I don't know where all the fish have gone, because it looks, everything else seems to be intact. There's animals, and anyway, maybe the ocean's particularly polluted. They make it to, I do like Peter Ustinov's old guy.
Yeah, I mean, he was pretty much in just about everything in a bit part at this point.
He's good. Peter Ustinov, isn't he? And he's kind of he's got a nice way about him. He's not the wise old sage. He's just kind of a lonely old man, really, who doesn't know a lot, but he's figured
out. And who hasn't actually spoken with anybody for 50-odd years.
Yeah, and sounds like it, but he's kindly, and they're excited because they've never seen anyone all crinkly and grey before. It's not clear whether he's the last man on Earth or what, really.
Hmm. He's the only one we meet.
Yeah, we never see anyone else.
So the implication might well be last man on Earth, but it's not stated.
And then Richard Jordan's character, I don't think we've seen him before in anything, but Francis, Logan's old partner, comes up, they have a fight, they kill Richard Francis.
The Sandman who's actually understood what they're about rather than believing the propaganda the way Logan has done.
Yeah, so, but at this point, it's very clear Logan is definitely not a double agent anymore because he kills Francis. Mm. And I was enjoying it. I mean, I there's a lot of fridge logic and a lot of, okay, I'll let that go. I was enjoying the story, but then it just takes to me this utterly nonsensical twist of, Logan saying, okay, we could have this huge, incredible life up here that we've never had before. I'm just going to go back and tell everyone. Okay, so that, I suppose, but we never had any indication before that Logan was this kind of, that kind of person, that he felt such a heavy weight of conscience that he would have to do that. But then it really takes a bonkers twist for me. They go all the way back down to the city. They promptly get, and then his plan to convert the people is basically, much like everyone else in these other two films, like Bruce Dern in Silent Running and like Charlton Heston in Soylent Green, his plan to convert people is to stand on a balcony and shout at them.
If 40 years of ranting with twigs in my beard has taught me anything, it's that people don't listen to the guy ranting with twigs in his beard.
Well, Michael York has the immense advantage of not having a beard, so you would think...
That may be his problem, but...
Maybe. He promptly gets captured, plugged into the AI, which immediately sort of melts down because it can't cope with the idea.
Well, specifically, it can't cope with the idea that Sanctuary doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe that's something that... No, this won't be something that's done better in the book, because in the book, Sanctuary does exist. So.
Right, okay.
And does it's off-planet.
Does the AI melt this?
I don't know.
But for whatever reason, the city then explodes.
Also, just a quick note here, during that interrogation scene, actual holograms. Remember actual holograms?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. During that sort of 5-year period when people thought they were cool.
Well, it does look cool. I'll grant you that. Not as cool as the Star Wars ones, which aren't actual holograms. Come on later. But so then at this point, I'd kind of checked out because it just doesn't... there's no sense being made anymore. I'm glad it had a happy ending, because it being a 70s film, I thought they'd just take him out and shoot him and that would be the end of it. So it was kind of nice that it did have a happy ending, sort of, in the sense that this wonderful utopia these kids are living in is destroyed, and now they have to now they have to live like animals on the surface.
So you've got no food, no shelter, no survival skills. Yay, welcome to Earth. I confess I'm somewhat reminded of the ending of the rather more recent Snowpiercer. Yeah, we've got this dystopian society on the last train going around the frozen Earth, and well, at the end the train is wrecked. Well, yay, now you're in a snowfield. That's a tiger over there.
Yeah, but it is a nominally happy ending in that they haven't kind of burnt the old man alive and tried to eat him yet, which happens fairly shortly afterwards. But yeah, they all come out and they can all live happily ever after.
Don't eat me, I'm tough and stringy, eat the greens.
Maybe this is just a prequel to Soylent Green. Anyway, yeah, that's Logan's Run.
I do like the visual stuff in the the models of the city are very obviously models, but they're good models.
They are. I don't, for me, having come off Silent Running, which honestly has much better model work.
Granted,
these do look like, you know, it's like someone's taken to their basement and said, "Look at this, you'd be really impressed." But for a film, they are obviously models, and it feels the need, like a lot of science fiction, to kind of go boo, 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 and crank the theremin out. It's not even a theremin; it's just beeps and blops,
computer noises.
Yeah, which just
and yeah, you probably weren't in that first home computer generation, which generated random, you know, a random pitch for a random duration sort of noise.
Oh, but I could do that on my Spectrum.
That was definitely a thing that happened. But yeah, here is an obscure thing, a new product which had just been gone onto the market, which they used to make it look all futury, rainbow tape.
Okay, yes.
That is why the rainbow tape in the city.
Right, okay. Well, it does look...
remind me slightly of a Doctor Who story from the previous year, The Ark in Space, where they used this new and obscure stuff called bubble wrap.
Well, this is... I think you mentioned off-air that a lot of 70s special effects are them just going down the equivalent of home base and buying whatever they found there, and it looking science fiction-y.
There is a huge credit for Farrah Fawcett, who has quite a small role. She's the assistant in the new face shop, which is a chain
kind of
interesting.
Again, she kind of dies because of plot at the end.
She got a huge credit after the fact because she had become famous in the meantime between shooting and release.
Right, fair enough. Okay, so then they played it up a bit. I mean, I really like the leads. I like Michael Yor. I like Jenny Agutter. I like Peter Ustinov. I like Francis as actor, whose name I've forgotten again, Richard Jordan. I liked the film. I mean, I didn't love it, but compared to the other two, I was enjoying it. And then
I do like the aesthetic in the city.
Yeah, I do. Yeah,
maybe it's very 70s, but it's a consistent aesthetic rather than just here's some crap we found around the place.
Well, and retrofuturism is always fun, seeing what, you know, people thought the future would be like from different eras. Yeah, but a masterpiece?
No.
Again, it's shot through with this guy. This is one that's a bit happier, but it's kind of the happy dystopia. Version, you know, the Brave New World style of dystopia, but it's still a dystopia. And I would say, I mean, having watched these three films, honestly not being massively impressed by any of them, you could just see coming off this the year before to Star Wars, which is actually, you know, it's been done to death.
A giant step backwards at the time, and Lucas was consciously imitating the classic Saturday morning serials.
Yes, because it's lost
it
any
works.
Of the kind of... Yeah, it's fun. There's no preachiness. There isn't this kind of core idea of a warning to humanity, which I would have more respect for in the other three films if any of them made any kind of sense.
That's the thing, yeah. I mean, I can see them trying to be serious and catering to a serious audience, but not themselves actually having anybody on the staff who is serious.
Yeah.
You know, in each case, these are book adaptations, and is Silent Running? I'm not sure. No, Silent Running, I think, is original film story. But the other two are book adaptations, and as the usual Hollywood thing, they just bought the rights and told the author to bog off. Yeah.
A lot of the book's central theme is to explore the philosophy and the idea that usually gets discarded in the film adaptation.
I mean, yes, one can see on the one hand that, but on the other hand, science fiction authors tend to be quite good at world building, or at least sometimes they are. At least better than your average Hollywood film person.
Yes.
And I do think the world building is quite lacking in all of these. There was a TV series spin-off of this.
Yes, I'd heard that. Any good?
I don't remember it. It began in 77. It had a season.
This is and, Logan's Run, isn't it?
Yeah. And basically by the end of season one, it was clear that ratings had collapsed because people wanted stuff that looked like Star Wars. It was basically, ignore at least part of the story of the book, of the film. We are going from place to place looking for capital S Sanctuary. And we solved the problem of the week. It was more or less how it came together.
The Littlest Logan, kind of. I sort of approached this sort of era of science fiction from the other end in that I grew up. I adored Star Wars as a kid. I still think it is a milestone. I think unquestionably a masterpiece. There's not a lot of point talking about it particularly, but you can see in contrast to this.
Yeah, I think Star Wars and Blade Runner are too big. We're never going to have an episode about these films.
Yeah, I think because there's not much to say that hasn't been said. But I suppose I came from it from the other end of that thinking, oh, I wish we could have a proper science fiction film instead of just these fantasy action films. That said, I mean, you know, Aliens, they're just incredible films. But having watched these films, I feel like, okay, I can see why people got sick of these preachy, serious science fiction films.
I mean, they're jolly good, but they're no Night of the Lepus.
What indeed is Night of the Lepus? Or Killer Shrew, even.
And I can sort of, well, yeah, a shrew will climb its own tail to bite you. the thing
I can see you pitching this idea to a movie.
I think it's been done. I do think it's worth considering what was lost with Star Wars, but having seen these, I'm not as convinced of the classic story that Hollywood was doing serious science fiction films and then Star Wars happened and it switched wholeheartedly to kiddie crap. Because, yes, it did switch wholeheartedly to kiddie crap, but it wasn't actually all that great before.
That, I think that's what it's made me feel. I mean, there were problems with Star Wars because it was such a behemoth and it turned everything into Battle Beyond the Stars or whatever. But, it wasn't amazing beforehand. I'm not even particularly a fan of 2001, which maybe we should do sometime. But it did cause problems, but I can see after these three, it was a huge, I mean, even Logan's Run, I suppose, is starting to feel a bit more hopeful, but Star Wars just knocked it out of the park with that. So Star Wars has been the silent partner in this one. This is the closest we'll get to talking about it in the sense that I can see the context it was coming out in now and why it just blew people away when it did. Well, there we are. I think we've said all we're going to, at least for some time, about 70s science fiction.
Yeah, it's been an interesting trip. No masterpieces, at least as far as I'm concerned, but
no, same.
I'm glad to have revisited these.
Yeah, I'm glad to have finally watched Soylent Green and Logan's Run. I don't think my opinion has changed much about what I thought they would be. But there we are. Okay, well, we shall leave it there and re-enter our own dystopian 2025.